Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. This is the final week of our series focused on candidates for Congress in New Hampshire's 1st and 2nd districts ahead of next week's primary. As usual, in one-on-one interviews, each candidate will have an opportunity to share their background, experience, and policy priorities. They will also answer questions related to the nation's fiscal challenges and how, as members of Congress, they might work to resolve them. This week, you will hear from 1st District Congressional candidate Mindy Mesmer, and 2nd District Congressional candidate Steve Negrin. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. A mad sprint begins this week to complete as many spending bills as possible before the new fiscal year begins on October 1st. But there isn't much time. There are only 11 legislative days this month when the House and Senate are both scheduled to be in session, and none of the 12 annual bills that fund the government have been signed into law. There are plenty of opportunities for the process to slow to a crawl or break down altogether. One example is the $1 million senators added to the labor, HHS, and education spending bill for the administration to draft regulations to require pharmaceutical companies to include pricing information and prescription drug advertisements. There's a question as to whether or not the Department of Health and Human Services can even legally require companies to list prices in advertisements. And the amendment's potential legal hurdles could slow efforts to get a final version of the labor HHS education spending bill to the president's desk before the new fiscal year begins. It was over almost before it began. The Trump administration threw in the towel last week on its second attempt to cancel previously approved spending authority through rescissions, this time by targeting unspent foreign aid. Administration officials had been considering a so-called rescissions package that would have asked Congress to cut between $2 and $4 billion in funding it had already passed for the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development. President Trump has rescinded a scheduled pay increase for federal workers next year, informing Congress that federal law allowed him to do so in the event of a, quote, national emergency or serious economic conditions affecting the general welfare. Trump said his action was driven by the national debt, now more than $21 trillion, and the annual deficit expected to be $804 billion in fiscal 2018. In February, congressional leaders created a 16-member bipartisan bicameral committee to overhaul the annual budget and appropriations process. The committee completed its required public hearings this summer. Members are now meeting in private subgroups to try and reach consensus on an array of issues. So far, members have not come to agreement on any ideas, but they have discussed moving the budget process from a fiscal year to a calendar year, moving from annual to biennial budgeting, changing the membership of the budget committee to make it more of a leadership committee, and involving the administration more in the budget process. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. Up next, I will be joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate Mindy Mesmer. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate and state representative Mindy Mesmer. Mindy lives in Rye with her husband and son. She's an environmental scientist who has a master's from Georgetown University, and she's a state representative in the New Hampshire House. Mindy is running as a Democrat to represent the 1st congressional district of New Hampshire. Thank you for joining the show, Representative.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on Facing the Future. And before we jump into any fiscal policy specific questions, I thought it'd be great for our listeners to get a good understanding as to why you're running for Congress to represent New Hampshire, what some of your top policy priorities might be.
So just a little correction. I have two sons, not just one. But I'm running because as a state representative in the House in New Hampshire, I realized that many of the things that I feel are really important to make some changes are federally preempted and require scientists. There's only one scientist in Congress right now, and he's dealing with a lot of issues that we have here in New Hampshire, but issues that require scientists, I think, to focus on a federal level. And I've been very involved with cancer prevention, chronic disease prevention, and environmental issues in the State House. Much of my legislation has been focused on that, but also other social and economic justice issues. And I think that, you know, sending a scientist to Congress to represent New Hampshire's first congressional district would help the state of New Hampshire that's facing extremely high rates of cancer and in breast cancer, bladder cancer, and pediatric cancer, the highest in the nation in New Hampshire, as well as some of the struggles we'll be facing as sea level rise starts to impact our seacoast communities.
And Representative, it sounds like as a result of your experience as a scientist and your emphasis on what's going on in New Hampshire as it relates to cancer, that health care would be a top priority for you in Congress. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. It's not a real secret that health care is very expensive in our country. We spend almost 20% of our economy on health care in some capacity. Programs like Medicare and Medicaid are becoming a very big need in our country, more and more enrollees in it. So I'm curious, with sort of the fiscal struggles facing programs like Medicare and Medicaid and the healthcare system as a whole, what would healthcare look like from your perspective? And if it requires expanding certain programs, how might we pay for them?
Serving on the Health and Human Services Committee in the State House, we worked very hard to make sure we got Medicaid expansion passed this year, which we were successful in doing. However, there were cutbacks in who would be covered for how long and various other things that make it more difficult for people to qualify for Medicaid expansion. And I think when you look at the way we cover health care in New Hampshire, there are a lot of holes for people that don't fit into the constraints. And so we have people that are not able to access health care in our state and in our country as a whole. We know that Medicare works for our seniors. Medicare is available. It's a structure. It's a program that works, that people love. When you ask a senior about what they feel about Medicare, they love their Medicare. And we think my plan is to make sure that we expand it so that it is accessible to everyone. And we know that when we started adding in some people, younger people into that pool, it will drive the cost down overall. The average will be lowered for people on Medicare. And so the program will be more cost effective. And in fact, the Koch brothers recently did a study on whether it would be what the cost would be associated with Medicare for All, and their results indicated that it would actually be cheaper than our current healthcare system if we employed Medicare for All.
And Representative, just referencing that study and, you know, studies from organizations like the Congressional Budget Office, there's been a wide range of potential costs associated with going to a Medicare for All program, anywhere from $15 to $35 trillion, depending on how the program is structured. So if we transition to a universal health care system like Medicare for All, and the Medicare trustees certainly aren't shy in saying the program itself is experiencing some financial struggle, it's one of its trust funds expected to be depleted by 2026, which means there's probably some reform that's needed in the program to at least make it sustainable long term. So if we moved to a Medicare for All system under your plan, would it be structured as, you know, a tax-only system, tax and premium? You know, how do we cover some of those costs of expanding coverage to our entire population?
Basically, Congress just has to fund it to be able to cover the cost. They, you know, if we expand it to be accessible to all, that will drive the cost down. I think we will need to reform some of the parts of the program, like Medicare Part D, that does not basically let the government negotiate pharmaceutical costs, which is really a big cost driver in our healthcare system right now. And I think we're going to see savings from some of the duplication of efforts and administrative costs, as well as a lot of the money being spent by healthcare insurance companies. Is 22% of the money they spend is on advertising. So some of those costs will go away, which will result in lower costs for implementing the program than our current healthcare system. And, you know, it's all about aligning our costs, our expenditures with our priorities. And as a first world nation, I think it is only appropriate for us to align some of our spending, instead of spending more than we were asked to spend for our defense budget, to put some of that money into providing medical care for everyone in our country, especially when the people of New Hampshire in particular have the highest rates of cancer. We know so many people of our citizens in New Hampshire are sick from cancer. So we need to be able to make sure that those people are not going to go bankrupt having to treat one of their relatives with a serious condition.
And Representative, you mentioned defense spending and perhaps shifting some money from that toward covering some of our health care costs. Defense spending falls squarely within discretionary spending in the budget, which is part of the appropriations process each year in Congress. So I'm curious, what would be some of your priorities in that budget appropriations process in discretionary spending? You mentioned shifting away from defense. You know, what would you channel that money into? Would it be R&D? Would it be other things? What are your top priorities on that discretionary side of the budget?
Well, certainly, I think that we could be spending more money in R&D to come up with programs that, help determine appropriate ways to treat cancer and chronic disease in our country, and education and infrastructure is a big need to improve our infrastructure across the country is something I would definitely want to appropriate funds for.
And just touching on infrastructure there, there's been talk in Congress in the last year and a half or so to invest in infrastructure at the national level, but the struggle has been figuring out a plan that adequately pays for it. That's sort of been the rub there. So what would an infrastructure investment plan look like for you, and how do you find the dollars necessary to get that level of investment?
Well, like I said, it's all about aligning our expenditures with our priorities and looking at where we can have some cost savings, where they can come from. I contend, various programs can be used to cut back, to put some money into infrastructure and education and various other programs. So that would be something that, I think we could look at closely about where we're spending money that isn't necessarily in line with our priorities.
And just to go into that a little bit more in finding ways to align priorities with necessary spending, right now, when you look at the budget and the construction as a whole, we've got mandatory spending, which is sort of on autopilot. It's programs that are written into law, like Social Security and Medicare, and then you've got discretionary spending. And right now, mandatory spending is about two-thirds of our budget, and then we're experiencing budget deficits almost in the trillions of dollars at this point. So is there a way that realign some of our spending to match some of the priorities you'd have in Congress in that environment, or do we have to find new areas of revenue? And then that jumps right into tax reform. So if we're talking about new taxes and some kind of tax code overhaul, what's that look like for you?
Well, first, I think we can remove the upper income cap on Social Security, and that would make that program solvent forever, basically. There's no reason why people that once they exceed a certain income threshold should not have to pay into that program like everybody else. So that would be my first, step in making sure that Social Security is there for seniors and for people that rely on that program forever. And the other issues are, basically making sure that we're not giving tax cuts to wealthy corporations and wealthy people at the expense of the rest of us. There were a lot of tax incentives, tax cuts given to wealthy corporations. Meanwhile, the rest of us were given tax cuts that will fade out in a very short time frame. So I think that, instead of giving wealthy corporations tax cuts, we can align, we can give some of that money back to the people and bring some of that revenue back into the mandatory spending.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with New Hampshire congressional candidate and state representative Mindy Mesmer. We're discussing her policy priorities as well as her take on some of the nation's fiscal challenges. And Representative, we have talked so far about a lot of big issues. We've mentioned Medicare and infrastructure investment and even dabbled in Social Security a little bit just now. And a real big issue in Congress at the moment is a lack of bipartisan work on some of these issues. So if you're representing New Hampshire in Congress, how do you get members of your own party and members of opposing parties on board with some of your ideas and initiatives?
One of the things that I'm really proud about my legislative record here in the New Hampshire House is just what you're talking about. I've worked across the aisle to make sure that I can get effective policy passed. 16 bills have passed through and been signed into law by the governor that have my name on them since I came to the State House. And I think in only 2 years, and I think that that is an important proof that my ability to work across the aisle. In fact, just a day or two ago, my campaign issued some statements that were given to us by some Republican colleagues of mine in the House in support of the work that I've done with them and how I've worked with them across the aisle to get those things done. And that's something that I think we need to do more in Congress. I think we need more people who aren't going to be divisive, that are going to go to Congress and say, you know, people that are, just because they have an R after their name and I'm a Democrat doesn't mean I can't work with you. And I would build relationships in Congress like I have in the New Hampshire House. I'm proud of that record here in the New Hampshire House that has enabled me to get so much work done on the state level. And I think basically the State House here in New Hampshire is a microcosm of Congress. They're about the same number of representatives. We have the second largest body, I believe, in the United States, our legislative body, and it's almost the same size as Congress and basically the same constituency as Congress, in my opinion. So I would continue to do the same kind of work down in Congress that I've done here that's really been effective in passing important policy.
And Representative, you mentioned some things that sort of allude to just a need for or acting upon leadership on these particular issues. There's a current proposal, or at least a committee out there right now, that is working on potential overhauls to the budget process. It's also not a secret the process has been crawling along for the last couple decades. We've been surviving on continuing resolutions and even experienced government shutdowns. Do you think that this committee could have success in some of its proposals in terms of bipartisan paths forward on the budget process, or do you think it really just comes down to leadership, is sort of what you were alluding to earlier?
I think it's a combination of factors. I mean, you know, they both are sort of intertwined. When you have leadership on issues, it requires you to work across the aisle to get things done. So I don't think either one of them is the path, but I do think that together, you know, we do need the social leadership. We need people that are willing to be a little bit bold and be, you know, work across the aisle and reach out to their fellow representatives to get things done.
And Representative, I do want to go back to one more topic that we just touched on, and that was Social Security. You mentioned raising the payroll tax cap, I believe, on that as a way to try and fund that program for a longer period of time. I had a broader question about that. The trustees for Social Security have indicated that the trust funds will be insolvent by 2034. Do you think we're at a point where Social Security needs to change for future generations because of how, say, millennials view Social Security and just sustain it for current retirees? Or do you think this is a program that can be saved for future generations? And is there any other reform beyond just raising the cap you think is necessary?
No, I didn't say raise the cap. I said remove the cap.
Okay,
I
appreciate the clarification.
The cap should be removed. Yeah, so in that way, it would be preserved for future generations. And I think that we should preserve that as a safety net for our seniors, for people that get into trouble. It's not just seniors that rely on that program. There are other people that rely on that program as well. And I think that it is a good program, and I think it should be preserved for future generations.
Do you think, just from a political perspective, removing the cap would be a difficult lift at this point? Or do you think that'll be something that can be easily conquered in Congress in the next several years?
It all depends on what the constituency is of Congress. I think that, you know, we are seeing a bunch of people making it through their primaries right now that I have full confidence in being able to get that passed. So it all depends on what Congress looks like after the midterms, but I'm fully, I'm going to go to Washington to work on these important issues because it's what the people want, and I am happy to represent their interests in Congress.
Representative, one of the other big topics of the day is economic growth, and we talked a bit about tax reform a few minutes ago, and there's been talk in Congress how the latest tax reform has helped spur on economic growth, but there's also the counter to that, in that it's helped grow budget deficits over the next couple of years. Do you think economic growth will be sufficient to help us increase revenue to the level that we can actually eliminate or reduce budget deficits? Or do you think it's going to take reform on both the tax and the spending side to help sort of bridge that gap?
Like I said earlier, I think that, you know, taking back some of the tax benefits that we've given large corporations and to the wealthy, there's lots of loopholes in our tax, our current tax code, that if we rein those in, we could make some real adjustments to what you're calling the deficit. Now, I'm not that concerned. I think the deficit is actually being run up just so that it's a political move, actually, so that we can say that we can't afford some of the programs that we've discussed here, like Medicare for All and Social Security any longer. So, I think that we should take a hard look at some of the benefits that we've given to some of the people that really haven't asked us for some of those benefits and rein those in so that we can, be more beneficial to the rest of us.
And you mentioned sort of eliminating tax loopholes or taxing corporations or those with higher incomes at a higher level. What would tax reform have looked like for you had you been in Congress this last year or so and putting forth ideas on how we can make reforms there?
Well, for example, we talked about some of the corporate tax havens, but there are also some ways that we can rein in some of the loopholes, like for hedge fund companies, for capital gains distributions have a much lower tax rate than income rates do, and some of those areas I think need to be looked at so that we can bring in some more revenue, some more tax money.
And we're running short on time, Representative, so I do have one more topic for you. And you talked about how you feel at this point the deficit is being run up as a political motivator, but we also do have a $21 trillion total national debt. And I'm curious if you think that we should make reducing that debt or leveling that debt as a percentage of the economy a priority in any policies that are put forth moving forward.
I think that we should stay focused on the programs that would benefit the American people. I think we should focus on getting Medicare for All in play. I think we should focus on raising the minimum wage for our working people. I think we should focus on strengthening our unions so that we are providing a mechanism to fight for the rights of the people in the workplace. I think there are some very important areas that we need to remain focused on, and that's what I would like to do when I go to Congress. In terms of, also fighting combating climate change and preventing contamination of our drinking water. These are the two top threats to our national security, and they are really going to be impactful to the people of this country if we don't address those with science and evidence and really look at ways to adequately address those.
And Representative, do you think we can achieve all those things without increasing our debt too much? We can find ways to pay for and investing in ways to control or reduce climate change, how we can invest in healthcare. Can we do all those things without seeing that $21 trillion debt that's being handed off to future generations increasing?
Like I said, if we rein in some of the benefits that we've given to in the tax code to corporations and wealthy people, and I think we can see some changes there. Absolutely.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire congressional candidate and state representative Mindy Mesmer discuss her policy priorities and approach to tackling our nation's fiscal policy challenges. Thank you so much for joining the show, Representative.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Up next, I'll be joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate Steve Negrin. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate Steve Negrin. Steve lives in Nashua with his wife. He's a retired Air Force officer and small business owner, has degrees from Texas Christian University and Western New England College, and he is a state representative in the New Hampshire House. Steve is running as a Republican to represent the 2nd Congressional District of New Hampshire. Thank you for joining the show, Steve.
Thank you for having me, Dave.
Well, it's great to have you on Facing the Future today, and before we jump into anything fiscal policy related, I wanted to give our listeners a chance to hear from you as to why you're running to represent New Hampshire in Congress, as well as maybe what some of your top policy priorities might be.
Absolutely. I sat on the Election Law Committee this last term in the State House, excuse me, and one of the things that I found that was very moving and profound to me is that people would drive 2.5 hours to be able to sit in front of the committee for 5 minutes of your time because they fundamentally believed that they could affect change, that they could actually have a voice, and their voice would be heard by their legislators. And that to me was very moving. It was really the way our government should work, that people, the constituents, should believe that they have a voice, that the people that they're talking to actually understand the position and carried it forward. And that was really probably the biggest thing that made me decide to run for Congress is that I don't believe we have that voice currently right now, and that's what I wanted to do for the second congressional district and the constituents.
And Steve, jumping in there and getting involved and representing the second congressional district in Congress, what would be some of your policy priorities right out the gate?
Sure, absolutely. Two of them jump off the page for me. Number one is the national debt. I think everybody talks about, you know, tax breaks and tax reductions, and we can talk about those, but nobody openly is really talking about, you know, that's one half of the equation. Where's the other half? Where are we looking at debt reduction? What are we looking at pulling the Band-Aid off and actually making some hard decisions and realizing that, you know, this is a national security threat to me. And as a military guy, you know, this country has been founded and people come here with an opportunity to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And I think the debt is something that's looming over us, and it's a train wreck that's about to happen, and I need to see more of that, and I believe that that's something I would love to champion and do and be a vocal part. And the other one is immigration. I am the grandson of a Mexican immigrant, but my grandfather came here the right way. We're a land of laws. We need to do it the right way. We're not doing it, and we need to get back to doing that. So those two things, I think, if I had to pare them down to two things, is one is immigration as a national security perspective and the debt.
So let's talk about that a little bit. You sort of played right into my hand on this show because we're talking about fiscal policy and long-term sustainability. We've got a national debt that's totaling $21 trillion. We're on the path to growing budget deficits in the trillion-dollar range as well. You mentioned it from your perspective. It's a national security threat. So if we're looking at, you know, leveling out or reducing the national debt or finding ways to bridge the gap in our annual budget deficit, how do you go about doing that in Congress from your perspective?
Absolutely. Well, I believe in an approach called zero-based budgeting. And what I've seen, primarily on the Department of Defense side, but I think it transcends to all the other departments, is that everybody believes that they're going to get at least what they got the previous year. And I think that's a bad starting state. I believe what people have to do is justify from a bottoms up what it is that they need and require to actually run an organization that they've been charged to do. And I've had to have that kind of hard discussions both in my own business and even when I was an Air Force program manager, when all of a sudden, you know, you submit a budget, what you think, and then halfway through a year or maybe a third way into the year, they say, you know what, I know you asked for $150 million, you're only going to get now 110. And the surprising thing is that we make it work. We may not be able to do some things 100%. We can do some things at 80%, but 80% is better than nothing. And I think when you charge people that this is the only thing you have, they'll surprise you. I know it's going to hurt. It's going to be painful to everybody involved, but you got to pull the Band-Aid off. And until somebody fundamentally looks at the people in the eye and say, this is all we have a process and we have a roadmap to get down to reduce this debt, this is what we're going to do, then I think that we're going to be able to do those things. And I think everybody's just a little bit afraid to do that because it may have some sort of effect 2 years down the road in a next election. But you know what? If we're sent to Congress to be able to be stewards of the taxpayers' dollars, then that's the thing that we have to do, and it has to be a collective effort, and it's not one party or the other, because it's really something that affects every American.
Steve, let's dive into that a little bit. You mentioned zero-based budgeting, which really only affects the discretionary side of the budget, which, as you mentioned, is part of the process or budget process that Congress manages or is supposed to manage on an annual basis.
Right.
You've got mandatory spending, which is pretty much on autopilot as programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and then we have the interest on the debt. So we'll set that aside for right now. Let's talk a little bit about discretionary spending. You mentioned your perspective would be hoping for zero-based budgeting, starting from zero in each agency, but what would be some of your priorities on the discretionary side? And if it involves more investment in certain agencies or certain areas, how would you pay for it?
Sure. Well, you have to make the assumption that you've got a finite amount of money. Hopefully, that's your first assertion. And not that we can look at other ways to do it. So you, in my opinion, you start out with a finite amount of money across the board, and then you look at where those monies are best suited. You know, what is my ROI from a business perspective that I'm going to get the most return? Certainly, from a national security strategy, which is my background, you want to make sure that we maintain an ability to protect the U.S. citizens both here and abroad. We look at some of those things, you know, and from like defense acquisition, weapon system procurement, you know, we spend a considerable amount of money, in my opinion, over than what we need to be able to buy capability and to be able to defend this country. I would look at certainly some of those things. And, you know, there's 12 authorization bills and 12 appropriation bills. And I look at each one of those with the same focus. Is that, okay, what is it that we need to fundamentally meet the mission, for lack of a better term, of each one of those entities? Let's pare that down, figure out what it is that we need. This really is not an area for fluff. And then once we figure what that out is using a finite amount of money, then I think that's how we start down the path. And each year, that finite amount of money, I think, starts from a reduction so that we're able to get down to a point where we reduce the debt.
And Steve, you mentioned the budget process, and right now there is a joint bicameral committee that's working on finding proposals, bipartisan proposals, to have reform in our budget process, because let's be frank, the last couple decades have been a little rough. We've seen government shutdowns and continuing resolutions, and right now we're trying to find ways to avoid that as a nation. So do you think reform is necessary in the budget process to get us back on a more sustainable track, or is it really an issue of leadership? If either one of those, how do you move forward?
Right. I think it's a combination of both, actually. You know, when you look at the OMB and GAO and then the president from the executive office putting together that budget, I think you need to hold benchmarks and milestones to these people and hold them accountable and hold them to task with some issues out there that if you don't meet a milestone, there's some ramification. I think it's leadership, quite frankly. I think, you know, you have to get out of the way of holding things hostage because it's not your pet rock. I think that the Congress has a fiduciary responsibility to make sure that they have and the president actually has a budget to present, not like a spending bill like which we had last December, but an actual budget so that the Congress can act on it. And it's going to take everything, right? It's going to take the legislative branch and the executive branch to work in harmony and understanding that there are gates that have to be met. The president and his proposed budget has to come through, and it's got to give time for the Congress to look at what it is so that they have an ability to make and to absorb it, because it's a behemoth. It's so unwieldy. We don't take the time to look at it the way we're supposed to do, and I think we have to look at what that reform could be to make it a little bit more manageable. And I think once we can put some of those two things in place, I think we should be able to do a budget within a year to be able to have Congress then act on it so that come on October, we actually have a budget the way it was always intended.
Steve, you mentioned the latest round of spending bills that came through in the last fiscal year, which also sort of leads me down the path of the recent tax reform bill that we saw. There's been a lot of projections from bipartisan organizations that the tax reform bill will put us on a path to adding to the deficit in the national debt, even when you factor in economic growth. So my question for you here is tackling our nation's fiscal unsustainability, our national debt, growing deficits, is that something that you think can be accomplished wholly on the spending side? Is it a revenue side issue, a combination of the two, like you mentioned with the budget process?
Sure. I think it's a combination of the two. I think the tax break in the short run, I think it's great. I think those need to be made permanent, but you cannot lose sight of the fact that you've got some very smart individuals saying, if you do nothing else but just let these tax cuts ride, it's really going to increase the debt. That has to be in lockstep with debt reduction because it's really a one-way street by just looking at it and thinking that in and of itself is going to solve a problem, which it isn't, in my opinion. So those have to be in tandem. And these tax cuts, in my opinion, short order, are good. But where are we with the tax with the debt reduction, which I haven't seen yet? And I think that has to happen immediately to be able to make sure that we can continue some tax reductions, but I have to reduce the debt. The one is not mutually exclusive.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with New Hampshire congressional candidate Steve Negrin. We are discussing his policy priorities as well as his take on the nation's fiscal challenges. And Steve, you mentioned how you felt that the recent tax reform bill had some positives in the short run, but you're a little concerned perhaps about the long run implications on the debt and deficit. If you were in Congress at the time, what would tax reform have looked like from your perspective? How do you set targets or even obligations perhaps on bringing down that debt in the long term?
Right. And that's the $64,000, not to bring an amount, but that's the hard part, right? So everybody wants to get, in my opinion, enamored with saying we've got all these tax breaks and it's great. But I would have been a very vocal proponent and said, okay, if you want my ability to vote on this tax package, we need to start addressing spending cuts right now in parallel. And I never saw that. You know, maybe there was some discussion, but it never bubbled up to the top so that the American people can understand it. Quite frankly, you know, I think we need to be honest and above board with the American people and say, you know, we have to reduce this debt. Tax cuts is one half of the equation. I would look at some areas. The one area I know well is on the Department of Defense side. I would have to look at the other 11 bills and figure out where there's some areas, because I think it's an approach, not necessarily the end state, that you can apply across the board that I think is where we need to be going.
Do you think economic growth will be enough to get us out of this situation, or is it a situation where the economic growth alone won't bring in enough revenue? We need to see some serious reductions in spending. And if it's the latter, where are you looking first?
Sure. So I don't believe that just the economic boom that we're seeing is gonna be able to override whatever debt we have. So it's got to be a combination of debt reduction. And when I talk to folks, to be honest with you, everything's on the table for me. There isn't anything that's a sacred cow. And everybody's going to be up in arms because they want to protect their little fiefdom. But if you're truly serious about debt reduction, then everything has to be on the table, and then everything has to be looked at equally. And I think that's the only way you're going to get from here to there.
Steve, we also, speaking of sacred cows, a very, very difficult topic to discuss in Congress right now is Social Security.
Yes, sir.
It's a very big mandatory spending program in a budget, and by mandatory, I mean it's simply written into law. It grows based off of demographics and formula. The trustees for Social Security have come out and said the trust funds are going to be depleted by 2034, which means we could see as much as a 24% cut in benefits across the board as a result of the trust funds being depleted.
Right.
Do you think reform is necessary in Social Security between now and then to set it up long term? Do you think we're at a transition point between generations where perhaps it looks different for millennials than it does current retirees? What's your approach on Social Security?
Sure. Well, you know, when I talk to a lot of folks on the campaign trail, you know, the option is if we do nothing, we know that it's going to end as we know it. So we need to be proactive. We have to understand and look at what is going to happen. And it's a very simple equation in my mind. Right now, we have less people putting in and more people taking out. And that's just a demographic of our nation. But the problem is that if we don't look at fundamentally how we change or how it's managed or what we do with it, then Social Security as we know it, and you can call it whatever name you want, but it's people paying into this. You know, it was never intended to be a retirement system, but it's supposed to augment. So we, if we don't do something fundamentally now and let it ride as it is, I think we're going to face, you know, a serious disaster for those people coming after the folks that are benefiting from it right now. So I would get some really smart financial folks in the room, figure out what it is from a very, very fundamental, you know, people putting in, what is it, what's the projections. And I've heard all the discussions about maybe I increase the age by which you can then draw out of Social Security, or maybe I reduce the amount of benefit that they get. Quite frankly, I don't know what those answers are. I do know that we have to put all this on the table and to discuss it, or we're going to have a situation where we're going to have to be reactionary. And when you're that way, you do something that's bad, and I think that would be more hurtful. So I think we need to start looking at that issue right now.
And Steve, just to follow up on that, how would you approach that reform? Would you construct it in such a way where perhaps current retirees or those about to retire are left harmless? Or do you think there's sort of this shared sacrifice that needs to occur between generations?
I think as best as I can, I would try to make sure that those that have anticipated and have earned their way to the point of where they are, is we impact them the least. Those of us who haven't started drawing on that, you know, as long as there's an expectation set, maybe the impact will be minimal, but it's going to hurt some people somewhere. In my opinion, you know, somebody's going to be angry. You just try to minimize what that angst is, and you have to look at where they are on a continuum, and I think that's the kind of approach I would look at.
One big topic that we haven't talked much about is healthcare. We spend close to 20% of our economy on healthcare in some capacity in this nation. Programs like Medicare and Medicaid are growing in cost. The healthcare cost per capita is actually going up, especially as we see this shift in our demographics. From your perspective, if you're in Congress, how would you approach healthcare reform? Do you think we need to tweak the ACA, move toward a universal system, scrap it all together and start over? What are you looking at if you're in Congress?
Sure. Well, the first thing, my personal belief is I don't believe the government should be in the business of healthcare. What we should be able to do is enable providers and bring down barriers to entry so that within a state like the state of New Hampshire, I have more options than the current ones that I have, the one or two that I have currently right now. I think the problem exists, and the reason why healthcare is so expensive is that we as consumers, we don't have the power to understand and make those decisions that I have a right and an ability to go get a procedure what's in the best interest for me as a consumer. for example, when I talk to people, I say, you know, you get an explanation of benefits or an EOB, and you see a line item in there for a procedure. Let's just say, I don't know, MRI, and it costs you $2,000. The problem is that as a business guy, I understand that that $2,000 rate for an MRI in an institution like a hospital or mandated by an insurance company, that's where you need to go, it's a wrap rate. So everything that the hospital needs to maintain, because it's a business, is loaded into that $2,000 rate. I'm proposing that if I, as a consumer, have an ability to go to company XYZ for the same MRI at 75% of the cost or 50% of the cost, I should have that ability to do that. I shouldn't be managed necessarily and dictated where I need to go. As a informed consumer, I should be able to go where I can, but that needs to be open disclosure as to what's available out there. And if somebody still wants to go to that hospital because it's more convenient for them and they like dealing with their insurance agency and they don't mind that bill, then that's their prerogative. But as for the majority of the consumers, I mean, we do comparative shopping and mostly everything else we do in life. And I think healthcare has to be given to the individual and let them make that perspective. And the other thing I would push is for health savings accounts. I think that's a great tool that's out there that allows both employers and employees to benefit from it. It hasn't really gotten the traction that I think it should, and I think that's be something I would be pushing.
Steve, is there any necessary reform from your perspective that needs to take place with Medicare right now, where its own trustees have also said one of its trust funds is close to depletion? It gets a lot of supplemental income from general tax revenue. Do you think there needs to be an increase in perhaps the payroll tax, a recalculation of the formula on benefits or premiums? What is your take on Medicare specifically?
Right. You know, I'm certainly against any kind of tax increase without understanding what the ramifications are. So just like I said, you know, about the other one, about Social Security, you know, what do we have fundamentally? How long is its purported life expectancy fit to be solvent and to do the things it was always intended to do? And if it's not meeting those gates, then I'd have to look at, you know, how do we fundamentally look at a different approach, still providing the coverage that's out there that people depend on, and to be able to do it a little bit more smartly. I think that when you look at, again, the finite amount of dollars that we have and going forward, I think it's another train wreck that's out there, and we need to start looking at it right now to make sure that it's going to be out there for the next 40 to 60 years.
Steve, unfortunately, we're running short on time, so I've only got one topic here for you that we can cover in this last minute or so, and that is the issue of bipartisanship, or partisanship, yes, if you will, in Congress. It's a very contentious environment right now. How do you get support for your ideas if you're a member of Congress? How do you get members of your own party and opposing parties to jump on board with some of the reforms you're thinking of?
Well, you know, absolutely, and I think the first thing you need to do is you need to treat each other with respect. You know, I remember growing up in the 80s and President Reagan, and I'll paraphrase it, that if you agree with me 80% of the time, you're not my enemy. So, you know, I think we've gotten to a point now, it's almost like a playground fight. If it's not by my way 100%, then I'm going to take my ball and go home. We got to get above that. We got to get past that. We got to get to a point that we know that when people can dialogue and come up to a mutual point, then everybody benefits. And I think that's really the basis of why we have the Congress that we have.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire congressional candidate Steve Negrin discuss his policy priorities and approach to tackling our nation's fiscal policy challenges. Thank you for joining the show, Steve.
Thank you, Chase, for having me.
And that's a wrap on our candidate interview series ahead of the New Hampshire primary next week. To all our New Hampshire listeners, get out and vote Tuesday, September 11th. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.